Hello everybody, how you doing? Hope all is well. Today's lecture is going to be about the fallacy of damnation. So this is for logic-based therapy. So once again, we're in the book, The New Rational Therapy by Dr. Elliot Cohen, getting our descriptions and suggestions for these episodes or these lectures. And let's start off with the three types of damnation, right? So just a quickly overview here. There's global damnation, which is damn the universe. If something bad happens in the whole world itself, it's just terrible. There's damnation of the self, which is to say, damn me, right? Condemning oneself. If I screw up or do something bad, then I myself am a worthless mess up. Damnation of others, which of course would be damn you. If someone else messes up or does something bad, then they are worthless or entirely bad. And what we're seeing here, I think, to use Cohen's words, and he's going to give us a description here of self-damnation that I think we can sort of run with, of course, for self-damnation as a definition, but also think it kind of succinctly and accurately describes how we might want to look at the other two forms of damnation. So he says, self-damnation is an extreme form of mock modesty. It is a false, overgeneralized, unrealistic underassessment of self-worth. So I think if we just replace even in that last sentence the word self with the worth of the world or the worth of another person, we get the sense that this is pretty applicable, right? So right off the bat, we're getting the word extreme as well in this definition. So we want to be avoiding extremes. As I may have mentioned, right, one of Cohen's other works is called What Would Aristotle Do? And Aristotle is big on balance, and we're going to hear from him later in some of these lectures, right? Because ultimately what damnation is doing, as I think the practical syllogisms I opened the episode with highlight, you're really jumping to some pretty serious conclusions here, right? And one distinction that Cohen draws nicely is that we have to learn how to separate between the deed or the action, or let's even say the event, and the doer or the universe even, right? So it's this idea that we take a leaf and we characterize the whole forest, right? And I think for me, I know I personally have a tendency to practice especially self-damnation, and literally almost exactly to the T of what the syllogism presents, right? If I mess something up, then I'm just either the day is ruined and I messed up the whole day, or I, again, start creating this narrative of myself. And one point that he's going to raise later that's really excellent is that what's especially sort of, let's say, insidious about these three different types of damnation is that when you do this, you're telling yourself a story, right? I think a lot of the way we approach life can be broken down into questions we ask and then try to answer, and then stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, others, and the world, right? And of course, also stories and questions that we consume from those sources as well, right? Being the world and others. That being said, right, when we start seeing ourselves, let's say, as losers, we start seeing the world as only terrible, or we start seeing our loved ones or our friends, our colleagues, only as terrible as a result of, let's say, one action or two actions. And of course, there are examples of actions that I would argue, you know, that's fair. So keeping that in mind, we want to think again about how this might be useful for us on more of a daily basis, right? So of course, there are certain actions that are absolutely terrible that would qualify or would warrant damnation, right? Of course. That being said, I think when we apply this more so, especially to the people that we love and we want to sustain relationships with that tend to get on our nerves, the things about ourselves that tend to bother us more than they should. And then also this idea that, you know, and I think we'll cover this in a later lecture as well, like the way we view the world, of course, affects the way we not only move on it, but also what we offer it, what we, you know, try to give to others in the world will largely be impacted by how we view those things. And again, the same thing could be said for the self, right? So what we want to avoid doing is this type of exaggeration, right? Where we don't see the goodness in things, where we don't see the goodness in ourselves, and we start creating these really extreme modes of condemnation, right? And I mentioned a moment ago the notion that some actions and some events in the universe, of course, are terrible enough to be characterized as such. But the idea especially is, well, to continue living, right, we want to make sure we're telling truthful and helpful stories and asking honest, authentic, and useful questions. Right, so it's not useful to, after failing one test, for example, or doing poorly in one meeting at work, or you have one argument with a friend, and all of a sudden you start canceling people from your life and or characterizing yourself as a loser or as someone who's never going to succeed, those aren't useful and they're not truthful, right? So I think we want to make sure that, you know, one, as we'll do right now in a second, like we have to locate how and why and when we might be doing this, right? So take a moment and fill in the next few sentences, right? Generally speaking, the world is, write one word, write five sentences, write five pages, whatever you want. Describe your perception of the world / the universe. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it chaotic? Is it rational? Why? Explain that a little bit. What are the events that inform your characterization of the universe? Then take a few minutes to think about the following, right? What do you tell yourself when you make a mistake? What do you tell yourself when you fail? What do you tell yourself before you try? What are you most afraid of messing up and why? And of course, all these questions, right? We always take time to address the why. Try to locate the moments, the memories that may be inspiring us to think and feel in this way. And we're examining our actions as well, right? Next one, when other people disappoint me, I usually fill in the blank. So take some time with those, I think, and start to see once again, do you commonly condemn yourself? So in relation to our last fallacy we discussed, demanding perfection, I think we do see some connections here in regards to the power of exaggeration, which will be sort of, or exaggeration or even underestimation, right? That's going to be a constant, I think, throughout a lot of these fallacies, right? Because what we're doing, when we'll get to the virtue in a minute here, that we're pursuing virtue, right? But what we're doing by that is creating balance, essentially, or pursuing balance. Right, so all these things are fallacies almost inherently because they're deficient or because they're excessive, right? So we're going to keep that in mind. That's similar. But I think the idea that from our last fallacy, right, that it's a problem to demand perfection, that's a little bit different than this one, right? Because demanding perfection is something you sort of, let's say, put out into the world. It's an expectation you're creating of yourself and of the world. This fallacy, I think, centers more around the characterizations we craft of the world, of others, and of ourselves as a result of occurrences. So we're not necessarily making demands for things to happen in the same way, right? Demanding perfection, I want things to go this way. And if they don't match that, it's a problem. And of course, that's a very summarized understanding. The other episode is still up, right? The other lecture is still available for more details on that. Whereas I think this is more about, it's almost a more human-centered fallacy, right? Because it's really aimed at the self, aimed at others and the universe. We'll characterize that for a moment. Although, of course, you could also characterize it, I guess it would be capital U universe to mean like our human realm and then beyond perhaps, right? If you're a person of faith. But it could also apply to, of course, to just mean the whole human universe, right? So I think ultimately, this is once again, a fallacy of characterization. Not as much as it is a fallacy of, let's say, let's say it's not as much a fallacy centered on the necessity or the perceived necessity for things to occur a certain way. It's almost a fallacy based on how we respond to those occurrences. And I think the details of this more revolve around how we characterize versus how we demand. Right? Again, there are some similarities here, of course, but I do think that's one subtle difference that might be useful or might be a useful distinction to draw, right? And just generally speaking too, right? If you're someone who's hard on yourself, this is a great chapter to consider, right? If you're someone who's hard on others, it's a great chapter to consider. And if you're someone who maybe has an unnecessarily or at times not even useful negative view of the world, right? And you want to improve that. Hopefully we'll have in the next few lectures, we'll have some suggestions for you that might be useful, right? So on that note, we want to talk a little bit before this episode ends about the guiding virtue to kind of pursue in light of or in spite of or to fight off these pathologies of the three different types of damnation, right? So it's respect. So what does respect do, right? Respect transcends the tendency to rate reality, which is to say the universe, including human reality, as utterly worthless or totally shitty, and instead looks for goodness and dignity. So that's, once again, a perspective shift. As I said, you're characterizing the forest based on the leaf. So focus a little more broadly to see that there is goodness in ourselves, in others, and in the world, right? Global respect avoids rating the whole according to the parts or the part and looks favorably on the larger cosmic picture. Self-respect involves unconditional self-acceptance based on a deep philosophical understanding of human worth and dignity. Respect for others consistently extends this profound respect for unconditional human worth and dignity to other human beings. Right? So once again, we're seeing the value. And to be clear, even let's say on a with a small example, it's okay to at times, I would say, be damning of ourselves and others, right? That's, it's going to happen because people will disappoint us, we'll disappoint ourselves. Horrible things happen. So once again, it's not about not acknowledging horribleness, right? That is something we have to do because a lot of horribleness, and this is going to be one of the antidotes, right? A lot of the horribleness we could hopefully fight. We could hopefully prevent it from happening again. We can learn from it, right? So of course that's important. But again, if we're going to be constantly damning ourselves, others in the world, we're not going to be thinking, feeling, and acting in ways that are healthy. So we want to maybe shift our perspective, ask where we're putting our focus, and try to highlight what's good and or what's worth fighting for and what's worth fighting against. Right? So hope this opening lecture was useful. We'll punctuate it there. And the following will be about a few anecdotes that I think might be useful to get us from the fallacies of self-damnation, damnation of others, and damnation of the universe, and get us pursuing the virtue of respect. Hope this was helpful. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you soon. All right, here we are. Welcome back again. Another lecture. Hope all is well. This section is going to be about anecdotes for global damnation. So before we get into Dr. Eliot Cohen's book, The New Rational Therapy, I want to read the last few paragraphs of The Plague by Albert Camus. So if you haven't read The Plague, I really strongly suggest it. And just to, again, give you a brief summary of the book, as the title implies, it's about a plague, right? So a plague hits a city and it's devastated, right? Again, very similar to recent developments around the world, right? The city's put into quarantine. And essentially, we follow the story of the main character, Dr. Rue, and his group of just various citizens that come together to basically fight against the plague. And again, I'm keeping that very sort of cursory. I do suggest you read it. That being said, I think the last couple paragraphs really speak to the following question that I would like for all of us to consider. How do you fight suffering? What we'll see later with Cohen, I think, also speaks to that question, the importance of that. One of the best ways to not habitually or unnecessarily or too intensely damn the universe is to be in a fight to improve it, to be actively in a fight against suffering. And we'll find that, again, when we'll find that to be the case with Dr. Cohen. And here we're finding it to be the case with Camus' character, Dr. Rue. So I'm going to read the last few paragraphs of this. I think it'll be very good to set up a conversation about some specific logic-based therapy anecdotes and ideas. And again, it's deliberate that I'm reading this, right? Dr. Rue is, I think, for Camus, very, you know, as the author, of course, as a creator of this world and this narrative, is very deliberately a doctor, right? When we talk about logic-based therapy, we've made this connection before that each of these anecdotes is, you know, the word anecdote is even very deliberate, right? There's the sense that there's something medical going on here to a degree, right? Philosophy as a form of therapy is this kind of interdisciplinary approach where we're using philosophy in a way that hasn't really been used, or it hasn't really been used much, let's say, in modern times, right? Again, ancient times, we get this tradition that speaks a little bit more to the sort of, you know, in quotes, obviously it's different, kind of medical approach. Epictetus, as I've said many times, right, described his school as a hospital for individuals grappling with, you know, unrealistic expectations, irrational emotions and thoughts, right? And he would offer antidotes essentially through philosophy. So Dr. Rue, you know, is not only a doctor in a literal sense for this plague, but he's also giving us antidotes as this, you know, as this piece reads allegorically in a number of different ways for the human condition. How do we wake ourselves up to make sure we're on the right side and that we're fighting suffering? That's a very philosophical conversation, right? about openness, about asking questions, about pursuing virtue, right? So it's really working on a lot of different levels. By that, I mean Dr. Root in the story, but also the story itself. So let me just jump in here and read this, and I think this will resonate, right? So Camus tells us, as Dr. Root is looking down, by the way, so let me just set the scene a little more, sorry. The plague here has ended. Ended in quotes, right? Dr. Root had just lost one of his closest friends. He's up on a balcony looking down at the city, opening its gates, letting people back who have been, you know, forced to leave or unable to return to their loved ones. People are celebrating below him, and he's looking down from this balcony, and he's having the following reflections, right? So Dr. Wu resolved to compile this chronicle so that he should not be one of those who hold their peace, but should bear witness in favor of those plague-stricken people, so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure. And to state quite simply what we learn in times of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in people than to despise. Nonetheless, he knew that the tale he had to tell could not be one of a final victory. It could be only the record of what had to be done, and what assuredly would have to be done again in the never-ending fight against terror and its relentless onslaughts. Despite their personal afflictions, by all who, while unable to be saints, but still refusing to bow down to pestilences, strive their utmost to be healers. And indeed, as he listened to the cries of joy rising from the town, Rue remembered that such joy is always imperiled. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know, but could have learned from books, that the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good, that it can lie dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chests, that it bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves, and that perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and for the enlightening of people, it would rouse up its rats again and send them forth to die in a happy city. I can't think of a better few paragraphs to start a conversation about how and why we shouldn't engage in the fallacy of global damnation than this. Because this is very honest, but it's also optimistic, right? It's honest in that the notion of the, you know, that the plague never goes away, that's human nature. It's making an argument here that the evil in humans, there's always going to be evil. Whether you want to make the argument that each and every individual has some evil in them, or generally, you know, people as a whole, there's evil floating around, right? And a lot of conceptions of, you know, what it means to be a person through philosophy, you see that. And a lot of conceptions about the universe that we receive from religions, we get that as well, right? Evil exists. And we're going to confront it again with Cohen in a second. And what he's saying here, and I love this about Camus, I think you even feel this in his other works in a number of different places. I think you even see this in his personal life, right? One of his famous quotes, of course, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm sorry, but we have to know who the executioners are, and we have to make sure that we're working against them, right? That takes courage to acknowledge that, to say that, and to stand against it. And I think what he's offering in that quote is very much, you know, in line with what he's saying here. Again and again, we find ourselves in predicaments where, even though we're not perfect, as he says, right, we have to stand up, as Rue did, and fight against the plague. In this case, the plague was carried by rats. In other cases, you know, again, this piece could be read as an allegory for World War II, Nazi occupation too, right? And the spread of Nazism and the Holocaust. It could also be viewed as an allegory, I think, in some ways, just for human history. That throughout history, when we even look at that century, right? You have the Namibian genocide, you have the Armenian genocide, and then you have the Holocaust. Right? Two of those three were perpetrated by the same country, right? So you have, I mean, these are very, very insightful remarks that Camus is providing here. Again, philosophically, allegorically. We can't be perfect, but we could do something good. The world has evil in it, but we can fight to have a world with less evil in it. We can fight to have a world that flourishes. We can fight to have a world that's more resilient against the plagues that arise. And whether you think that begins with the world or begins with the individual, he's encouraging us here to see ourselves as a part of something larger and take action, right? Because this stuff is either here or it's waiting. This stuff meaning the ugliness, the evil, the evilness in the world. No victory against this can be final. We have to always be working. We have to always be vigilant. It's no mystery he wrote the myth of Sisyphus, right? It's a constant thing. Right, so again, what he's asking us here, I think, is not to be pessimistic. If we're striving, or almost to be healers, through that striving, that's where the meaning and the fulfillment of life can come. And to heal is such an incredibly powerful and important thing to offer ourselves and others. The tools, the time, the energy, the attention to heal ourselves, and again, offer that to the world. I mean, these are beautiful remarks, I think. They get us thinking about how to respond to such an imperfect and at times terrible and horrible world. To say it's horrible and turn our backs on it isn't going to solve anything. And even trying might not solve anything. Maybe, but for a moment. And I think Camus here, again, is providing us this sort of almost like this encouragement that is eternal in a sense. For as long as you live, try to do this. No matter what you do. So I think, again, I hope that these few paragraphs resonated. I do suggest you read the book. And let's get into what I think connects really nicely, which is the antidote from Dr. Cohen, right? Instead of complaining about the shit in the world, do something to make it better. And he provides a couple perspectives here that are in line with this, right? So one is Mani, the Persian philosopher and religious figure, the founder of Manichaeism, right? And Cohen tells us, quote, "Ancient Persian philosopher Mani taught that the world consisted of two opposing forces, good and evil. Evil is rooted in matter, while good is in the spiritual, rational nature of human beings. This became a basis of a religious perspective, Manichaeism, according to which the ultimate goal of human beings is to free themselves from the oppression of evil, which weighs down the soul." Right? So that to me is very interesting and very much in line with Camus' notion of finding out where the evil is and standing against it, right? That we get from the plague, and that other quote that I paraphrased about knowing who the executioners are, right? And then again, choosing to stand against the suffering they cause, the injustice they cause, and understand that that's going to be, or that should be, a staple of who we are and what we do, right? So Manichaeism, I think, presents another really great sort of, let's say, perspective on why we should strive for goodness. The evil should not only discourage us, and it might, and that's okay at times. But if the ultimate goal is to be free of this oppression of evil, it requires a Dr. Rue approach. It requires a logic-based therapy approach. Right? When he's talking about weighing down the soul, right? What we're doing in philosophy is this is a soul conversation. Right? Logic-based therapy focuses on how we think, how we feel, and how we act. That's a pretty, I mean, even just the tripartite nature of that, right? Mind, body, soul, act, think, feel. So here we are, right? We're here constructing tools similar to what a doctor might do to diagnose ourselves. And then once again, the word antidote fits nicely into this idea. So we acknowledge the good and the evil, and we pursue the good as a result of Manichaeism, right? Through these spiritual types of exercises, right? Then he presents another perspective from Mordecai Kaplan. Okay, Kaplan thinks that good is to be identified with the rational, purposive elements in nature and ultimately with God, while evil is irrational and chaotic. Since organized, purposive efforts usually win out of disorganized, chaotic ones, Kaplan thinks that good will triumph over evil in the end. We say where there's a will, there's a way, but that we record the experience that despite the obstacles to a determined will, presented by circumstances which are fortuitous or which are less informed by purpose or plan, the determined will is bound to win out in the end. So it's up to you to make the practical effort to reduce the amount of evil in the world so as to leave the world the better for our having lived in it. Here then is another antidote to global damnation. Instead of damn the universe, become active in the fight against evil. In damning the universe, you are simply giving up on the world, tossing any hope to the wind. If the universe is truly worthless, then there is nothing you can do about it. That's why this fallacy is so damn depressing. On the other hand, if you enlist yourself in the cause of world improvement, you aren't going to rid the world of all the evils, but you will at least make it better. And that's what Dr. Rue did, right? He not only constantly as a doctor fought the plague And we find him working to help others and heal others before the plague even starts in the book. But he goes out. He starts what the book refers to as the sanitation squad, right? He kind of works in community with others to fight the plague and do whatever they can. And at times it is absolutely dire what is happening in Iran, the city where this takes place. So we have to, I even like this, the sort of language Cohen is using here, right? The idea of enlisting ourselves. Right, leaving the world a better place. It makes us think of that ancient Greek idea, eudaimonia, right? The idea of fulfillment. Back to Camus a little bit on striving. That striving is where we find our fulfillment. And one part of eudaimonia too is the idea that we do leave the world better than how we found it. So it's not just to cave and be pessimistic only. You can be pessimistic, but even that pessimism, we could use it to fuel what Kaplan is saying here, what Manny is saying earlier, what Dr. Rue did in the story, right? How can we acknowledge the world's terribleness, have an action-oriented approach to creating goodness, and do so in a way that's as healthy as possible for us? So Cohen provides some advice here, right? We have to define for ourselves what he refers to as constructive works. Okay? So this is a very sort of Aristotelian action-oriented approach. Give your day a project, give your week a project, give your career a large sense of purpose, and let that, you know, at least part of that, let's say a large part of that purpose be to heal. No matter what you do, I think we can carry this with us, right? We have to, as Cohen's saying here, right, we have to be able to say what is wrong before we can fix it. So as I said earlier, we have to acknowledge. It's not about ignoring the suffering at all. It's not about wishful thinking. It's not about blind optimism. We should be able to stick to rating the things in the world, the terrible things, rather than the world itself. There is shit in the world versus the world is shit are very different ideas. Similarly, right, it's much different to say, I messed up today and I am a loser or I am a mess up. We construct the narrative, as I said, I think in the first episode, and then that becomes a story we tell ourselves. It becomes what we believe that usually will impact how we behave. And how we behave impacts everything. Right, so if you only ever see the world as a terrible place, it's unlikely, let's say, it's more unlikely that you're going to try to change it for the better. If you characterize yourself, and now we're getting into self-damnation a little bit here, right? But I think it fits. If you constantly damn yourself as a loser, you'll start acting like one. So we have to avoid thinking and feeling in those ways. So think a little bit about Camus. Think a little bit about Manny. Think a little bit about Kaplan. And start to see the world as something that you can influence. Right? So that first question we return to for a moment, right? How can you, or how have you, or how do you fight suffering? Which might be to say, in the context of global damnation too, right? What else can you offer the world? And always start small, right? How could you offer more happiness and joy to the people around you? How could you be more attentive? What cause? That's a very relevant conversation. That you can authentically and truly donate, give of your time, of your energy, of your resources. I love the encouragement here to take action, to be, let's say even, to use this language, to be a healer, to enlist ourselves, to not simply talk about how shitty things are, but to take action to improve them. I've had a number of conversations recently as a student myself that are just so unbelievably pessimistic, right? And to what degree does that pessimism turn into something else, right? Because what is pessimism when you're talking plus doing nothing about it? That's got to be something else, right? So we want to make sure there's something worse. To be pessimistic, yes. Yes. Camus is, again, I don't think he's only a pessimist, but he's saying evil is going to exist throughout. And even when it's not that readily or tangibly, let's say, palpable, or, you know, maybe you can't even articulate it. It's just waiting, right? So we stay vigilant over our own souls to make sure what we're putting out into the world is positive. And then we work with the world to shape it, not just to characterize it. Okay, and a part of what we said with the first episode is that this is a fallacy that primarily revolves around characterizations. And now we can add to it too. It revolves around characterizations and a lack of action. Right. I think a conversation I often have with students around, let's say, one topic that has come up in the past is maybe changing some consumption habits, right? Just for one example, eat a little bit less meat. Why? Because it's just one, you know, there's a huge list of why potentially, right? But a conversation I have with students often might be, okay, well, maybe some of us at this time are not willing to become vegetarians or vegans. Okay. Understandable to an extent, right? Understandable in quotes. But ultimately, if you could eat a little bit less meat, that's still a positive thing. You're still doing better for the environment, if that's the one argument. Of course, it's one argument, right? If that's the argument we want to go with. But what students have a tendency to say might be, well, the meat's there anyway, so if I buy it, it really doesn't matter. And there's a lot of problems there, right? So there's a practical idea that it does matter from a literal sense, from like a business sense, supply and demand, right? That there's a relationship there. And additionally, you're taking your own power away. Do a good thing because it's a good thing. Right? Don't make all these negative assumptions about the world. If it's a good thing to do, do it and let it be. And maybe this is, again, aspirational, right? But at the very least, don't limit your ability to offer good things to the world and make it better in the face of what at times could be an honest and truthful characterization of its horribleness. But that characterization has to become useful by trying to do something, trying to shape the world in a way that improves it. Like, we're sitting here talking, show me. Yes, it's broken. Okay, can we try to fix it? That's what I think Dr. Ru, he didn't just sit and observe the plague. He got involved. Manny is saying, right, be rational. Choose to fight against the evil. Kaplan, same thing. Enlist yourself. So okay, take account of how you might already be engaging with the suffering in the world, your own suffering, the suffering of the people around you. And as we said with our early conversations, right, the final step of the logic-based therapy process is to create a plan of action and then take that action, then reflect upon it. Right? So instead of just damning the world, as Cohen says, right, it's almost to turn your back on it, try to offer something new maybe. Offer something that's uniquely your own that could be of benefit. This is that moral development aspect of LBT. Right? And also, you'll feel better about the world too if you look at it more positively, because guess what? You're a part of it and you know that. We're aware of that. So I hope this was helpful. And thank you for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Hello, everybody. How you doing? Hope all is well. Here we have another lecture with the damnation fallacies. We're going to be talking about damnation of the self for the next few minutes. And of course, we're going to be referring to Dr. Elia Cohen. Also in this brief lecture, we're going to have a little bit from Rumi. And that's where I actually want to start today, right? So I want to share a little bit of a selection from Rumi here, a couple of brief quotes. I'm a fan of his poetry, so I think we'll appreciate it. And it'll raise some questions for us, I think, and also get us moving in a good direction to discuss some antidotes for self-damnation, right? So here's the first brief Rumi selection. This is great, I think. Here we go. You were born with potential. You were born with goodness and trust. You were born with ideals and dreams. You were born with greatness. You were born with wings. You are not meant for crawling, so don't. You have wings. Learn to use them and fly. To me, that's just a great commentary on like the intrinsic value of being a person, which is going to be really essential for some arguments we're going to talk about with Cohen that Kant makes, right? I love this. Like, put this in your mind for like, how would your life be different if you really believed this? Right? And I think for me, you know, my understanding of Rumi has grown over, you know, recent history. I've been reading some of his poems. I've been reading a little bit about him, right? Kind of adopting what we may characterize as a co-creator model, I think, to an extent. Right? One of his poems discusses this notion of climbing a ladder up to God, up to virtue, right? You know, saying that there is a higher power, right? But it's up to us to sort of use our hands and feet to climb the ladder, right? That we're given, like we're given this ability to do it. So there's sort of like a you know, we share responsibilities in a sense for pursuing goodness as people with a higher power. I think that's really nice. I think that's just a powerful idea. And then this is like, again, like you have to actualize your potential, but you have it. right? Like this idea too of like destiny, right? You were destined to fly. And I love the idea of flying, right? The notion of ascent, moving up towards what? Maybe it's, we go with a kind of a platonic sun, right? The sun of being truth, virtue, right? Constantly moving up, or to the best of our ability, right? Learning to use them, like these wings that we have, these resources, this potential to go beyond our current selves into or towards our higher selves, our healthier selves, right? So really, I think just a beautiful poem there, very philosophically profound. And again, this acknowledgement, as you know, as Kant would say, like, you know, you're in Aristotle too, right? You're rational. And as a result of that, like there's a great deal of potential there, right? Aristotle case, you know, of course, you know, famously said, we are rational animals, right? So it's like, we have this unique thing about us as people. Right. Even to work on this poem a little more, right? We were born with goodness and trust. It doesn't say you're born entirely good. Also interesting, right? So there's a sense that we have to grapple. Maybe, right? I'm adding that a little bit, but I think that's an interesting point. You have this ability to move above, right? So when we're talking about logic-based therapy, rational thinking skills, like what we're studying here is spiritual transfiguration, right? You can become someone who is more patient, for example. Someone who's more courageous. And a part of the thing that will stop that is practicing too much self-damnation. As we'll talk about that in a minute. One more quick Rumi quote that I love, that I think speaks to another thing we'll discuss with Cohen. Where there is ruin, there is hope for treasure. Right. So one of the things we'll talk about with self-damnation is like, you don't handle failure well. And as we said already, I think in the first episode, you mistake an action or a deed or a mistake for your whole personhood. You make that exaggeration, right? I don't know why I pronounced the word that way. You make that exaggeration, right? As Cohen says, now we're going into the book we're always using, right? The New Rational Therapy. Here in Damnation of the Self, you confound failure with being a failure, performing an unworthy act with being unworthy, making a mistake with being a mistake, and doing something shitty with being shitty. So back to the idea of the deed and the doer. So Rumi is giving us encouragement with this first poem, like to characterize the doer, which is the self, in this positive light. Even if we mess up, there's potential for greatness here. But we have to learn. Okay? Now, one point that Cohen raises that then speaks to the second Rumi quote, I believe, is that this fallacy prophetically leads to further screwing up. That word prophetically is really cool. You make your own future. Because once you say to yourself, instead of I messed up, let's move on. I can learn. I can move beyond this. Like there's treasure here in this ruin. You start seeing yourself in some kind of way. I don't know much about birds. I'm pretty sure that a pigeon, not a pigeon, bad idea. I'm pretty sure that a penguin is a flightless bird, right? So, you know what? I'm actually not going to go into zoological metaphors right now. Let's just stick to the reading. Okay. Bottom line is the way we see ourselves, I'm not re-recording this. The bottom line is the way we see ourselves, the stories we tell ourselves, right, will likely impact how we're going to try to shape ourselves. If you see yourself as a failure, that conception of you is not going to help you become not a failure. As Cohen says, once you step into the shoes of a failure, you are obliged to walk in them. And let's interpret that as broadly as we can, right? Because I think we all, I mean, again, some of us may not be doing this at all, of course, right? But ultimately, we all are likely doing this in some way. Maybe it's, again, stick with our two main categories for a moment, right? In work and in love. Right, once again, we take a leaf, one bad relationship, and we start characterizing our whole existence with relationships, our whole future with relationships. We see ourselves as incapable of having a healthy relationship. Right? Same thing with work. We get rejected from a few jobs, we see ourselves as incapable, or we see ourselves as unwanted by that field or something, right? And we have to be careful about this. We're inviting prophetically the exact result that we don't want. Okay, we've kind of in so doing, right, by stepping into the shoes of the failure, by walking in them, we have a prepared excuse for failing. That's what I'm supposed to do. It almost becomes what we aim for. This is the self-saboteur, right? We talk about this in the School of Life does a great piece on this when they discuss relationships. We sabotage ourselves in relationships and or in work situations. Again, I think Cohen's very deliberate with that use of the word prophetically. You're predicting your own demise. You're so afraid of the relationship ending, or you're so afraid of failing at the interview that you get nervous and you actually fail. You're afraid of the relationship ending so much so that you don't open up and never even starts. Right? And this is a great Sun Tzu quote that I think speaks to this, right? Where a target is hung up, arrows will find their way to it. So when you tell yourself and you go from I failed to I'm a failure, now all of a sudden you have a conception of you that kind of becomes an aim in a sense. Or at the very least, it becomes something that you are more likely to reinforce because it's how you see yourself. The future is now is an interesting idea, right? If you see yourself as a failure now, you're carrying that with you. That's going to impact your future. And then again, it's going to relate back to your past, right? Because by that I mean, okay, I'm a failure now. Let me carry that weight. I'm viewing myself in this way, so I'm going to act like that. So I'm going to fail again tomorrow. And then when tomorrow comes, I'll look back and say, oh, I failed again. And I just failed last week. And you start reinforcing the narrative. That reinforcement is a type of prophecy. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, ultimately, is what I think he's trying to convey here. So we need to tell new stories, right? So right off the bat here, let's take a minute and let's dive into these questions, right? For some philosophical meditation. We need to confront that narrative, right? So what was your greatest achievement? Or let's say, what are your greatest achievements so far in life? Big question. Let's even make it more specific, right? Biggest achievements this month, this week, this year, today. We need to think about these things if we suffer from self-damnation. We have to realize that nothing is too small. If it's good, if it's just, if it's authentic, if it took effort, right, we should celebrate it. Nothing's too small to celebrate. And that's when we start confronting, because self-damnation is not fair. Okay, a lot of the things I think ultimately, I may have mentioned this already, right, boils down, by that I mean a lot of these things we think about, the ways we feel, the ways we act, a lot of it boils down to the questions we ask ourselves most frequently and how intensely we try to pursue meaning and answers of those questions and how well-constructed those questions are, what their aims are. And also, I think it really boils down to the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, others, and the world. So if all you see, to kind of relate to the last lecture too, if all you see is the world is shit, you start accepting that and you become an observer, not good. Then the same thing with self-damnation to an extent, right? You see yourself as this way, you will make that a reality. Our mind, our body, and our souls are always communicating with each other, right? So we have to keep that in mind. So confront, especially if you're someone who suffers from self-damnation a lot, confront your own achievements. Let's build some confidence. The guiding virtue of this set of fallacies is respect, which I think is great, but also confidence is a virtue we want to think about here. If you're constantly self-flagellating, just constantly punishing yourself, you're never going to feel good about yourself. So maybe you need a confidence boost self-writing practice. At the end of each day, remind yourself what you accomplished and be honest. And we'll talk a little bit in a moment about also acknowledging how you failed, but we don't make that jump, that illogical jump. From I messed up to I am a mess up, because you're not serving yourself or anybody else if you think that. So we have to learn how to accept what we have done right and what we've done wrong. And a lot of people who suffer from self-damnation are only having one of those conversations, and they're focusing way too intensely and frequently on what they do wrong. So easy way to fight that, you got to have a self-writing practice where you regularly sit down and think about everything you're doing right. And if there is enough things there that'll bring to your attention, you can start doing things better. A lot of benefits to that, right? So let's get into some of these anecdotes from Cohen. So the first one I think is interesting, and it speaks to the first Rumi poem as well. He tells us, accept your self-worth unconditionally, not as a variable that changes with successes, failures, or the approval and disapproval of others. So one of the most common ways that we damn ourselves is through what Cohen describes as achievement damnation. Okay, this amounts to telling yourself, this is from Cohen, that you must achieve your mark in order to have worth as a person. This, I think, goes back a little bit, and I apologize if I'm not remembering this correctly. This might've been my other class, but when you put too much of your self-worth into your achievements, it's easy to start confusing this with like a virtuous type of drive. We are trained to always want more, not a good thing. We are trained to always hustle, and that anything that isn't hustling is lazy, also not a good thing. Right? Because it leads to this. If I'm not constantly achieving, I'm worthless, I'm useless. Not true. Rumi would disagree with that based on the poem, and Kant would disagree with that too. Right? It's almost as if you're treating your whole existence, the way you use your time, the way you use your effort, your intentions, right? All these things as means to some other end. Instead of seeing that your ability to exist and experience life, to rationally understand life before you even take action on it necessarily, is something valuable. Right? According to Kant, this is from Cohen, because people have the capacity for rational decision-making, they have a dignity that should be respected. Since people, unlike mere objects, can rationally determine their own course of action, they shouldn't be manipulated and used as though they were just things. So that goes for the way we treat others and the way we see ourselves too. In contrast to mere objects, the rational nature of persons does not depend on how useful they are or how well they satisfy someone's desires or purposes. The value of a person is a constant, not something that can be diminished or increased with its usefulness. Kant is saying that you should not only treat other people as ends in themselves, but also extend that same respect to yourself. But obviously, in damning yourself, what you are doing is violating this command to unconditionally respect yourself. You are denying your self-worth as though your worth as a person could be subtracted from you like some object. So that's exactly what happens when you practice achievement damnation. Okay, we have to accept your self-worth unconditionally as an unconditional command. Regardless of whether you win or lose or succeed or fail, you are still a person with dignity, come hell or high water. There's still potential in you, to use Rumi's idea. That rationality represents potential to choose a new course, to see how you failed and how you can grow from it. But again, back to Rumi, find the treasure. And there's something to value there. There's something worth something there. We can't ignore that. Right? And the idea of ignoring, again, goes back to my suggestion for the practice. You're ignoring what you're doing right. It doesn't make sense. You're torturing yourself. Okay? And back to global damnation for a moment too. Don't ignore, even if something small is going right in the world, try to acknowledge it. Let's go on to another anecdote real quick that fits into this idea of ignoring as well, right? When you talk to a good friend, especially if they're trying to help you through a failure, they don't just focus on the failure, right? They don't ignore everything you're doing right. They highlight that stuff. They try to encourage you by, again, hopefully you have friendships like this, right? They honestly encourage you while maybe correcting you, of course, right? Or giving you constructive criticism, but it really shouldn't just be that, right? A loving friendship or a relationship or a family relationship shouldn't be characterized only by condemnation, right? So this next anecdote from Cohen is, love yourself as your own best friend. Assess your accomplishments rationally and wish yourself well. Be your own best friend. I mean, that's great advice. And I think I mentioned this already in class, but when you're doing your self-writing, if you do, or even when you're thinking to yourself, try to use the word you instead of I. Because maybe, and I think there's some relevance, or let's say some power to this, more so is a better word. That gives you distance and it helps you start talking to yourself like you're a friend, which then might help you start treating yourself like you're a good friend. Okay, we need to commit to rational self-assessment. Okay, and a person who truly loves himself or herself or themselves would not berate and degrade themselves, since this is to fly in the face of reason. So that idea too is to avoid extremes. Don't berate yourself. Don't degrade yourself. Rationally assess yourself. Epictetus would say self-scrutiny applied with some kindness. Most of the time, I think, is a good addition to that too. Right? sometimes we might have to be a little, you know, not a little, sometimes we might have to be a lot a bit hard on ourselves, but try to reserve that. So once again, how do you talk to your friends? Become more conscious of that. Try to adopt that voice. The next time a friend comes to you with a problem, hear how you talk to them. Be more aware of it so you can start using that language, that tone, that emotional tenor when you speak with yourself. And let's move on to the last anecdote I'm going to highlight for today, which is, instead of withdrawing from life for fear of failing, live and learn from your past mistakes. Okay? Failing is an essential part of trying. Improve by experience. Right? Aristotle famously said, Nicomachean Ethics, right? We learn by doing. Well, you're going to fail when you're doing stuff, but the worst is to not try at all. Once again, the worst in some cases might be to never even give an effort. There's a great book I read recently called The Medici Effect. And one of the great points it raises is that a lot of times quality comes as a result of quantity, which is to say you have to be willing to try a lot and fail a lot in order to make something good. And then it's like, okay, well, maybe I can understand that, but I have to really accept it as a fact. And then not let myself feel bad about the failing, right? So Cohen elaborates on that a little bit, and he provides us with the following in regards to how to relate to failure, right? If you take failure as signifying lack of self-worth, then you'll learn nothing. On the other hand, if you look on it as an unavoidable, which is, again, back to the Medici effect, right? You need quantity for quality. It's unavoidable you're going to mess up. So if you look on it as an unavoidable, useful component of learning and growing in life, then you can be the greatest gainer in the long run. Human beings are imperfect by nature. We are born to mess up. Mess up gracefully. Accept yourself and learn from your mistakes. So another question you might want to think of, right? Think about your biggest mistakes. This is not fun, right? But it's necessary. This is uncomfortable, but it might be good. There might be growth here, right? Think about your biggest mistakes in your life, this year, this week, today. See them as lessons. Try to embody this. Right? These set of notions, right? Again, back to the Rumi, where there is ruin, there is hope for treasure. Take that hope, try to do what Cohen's saying. What did you learn? I think this is actually very therapeutic. Take your failed initiatives at work. Take your failed classes in school. Take your quote-unquote failed relationships and turn them into something else. Turn them into lessons. Honestly appraise them. What choices did you make? What choices did the other individual or the other individuals, depending on the circumstances, what choices did they make? How did the universe maybe get involved? How did you respond to that? Really examine the mistakes. Learn from them and then leave them. Again, don't let these mistakes become ways you characterize yourself, especially if that characterization is not going to help you move forward in a way that is the best way possible. The process of even writing about that will help you leave it behind. Take the paper, throw it out, rip it up, burn it. The last one's kind of extreme and unnecessary, but I don't know, just things to think about. Go throw it in a body of water, not like in a littering way, but you know, I get a metaphor that is littering, but it's also metaphorical. Let it go. You know what? Don't do the last two suggestions. Just rip it up or throw it away. I take the last two back. I'm not encouraging either of those. Although they are, again, metaphorically pretty cool. On a serious note, examine the mistakes, examine the achievements, and see how you feel, right? Keep in mind, once again, that the key of the practical syllogism is that you're confusing the action and the deed with who you are as a person. We can navigate that. Think about these anecdotes, think about the poems, and I would really suggest sitting down with some type of practice to examine the mistakes, and maybe a more frequent one if you really struggle with self-damnation, where you kind of applaud yourself in a realistic and confident way in regards to how you succeed on a regular basis. We have to remind ourselves of that, especially if we're suffering from self-damnation. Hope this is helpful. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.